They must learn to be open to new thoughts and ideas and practice tolerance toward different beliefs, ethnicities, races, and religions. They need to learn about basic human rights and America's responsibilities in the world. As political philosopher Martha Nussbaum has suggested, students should learn not only that citizens of India have equal basic human rights, for example, but also about the problems of hunger and pollution in India, and the implications of these problems for the larger issues of global hunger and global ecology. Civic education must instill in young people a passion for truth. It should enable them to think critically, be skeptical, but not cynical, about what they hear and read, find reliable sources of information, apply basic logic and analysis, and know enough about history and the physical world to differentiate fact from fiction. They need to understand how important the truth is to democracy and to our capacity to deliberate together about the common good. Such an education must, finally, encourage civic virtue. It should explain and illustrate the profound differences between doing whatever it takes to win and acting for the common good, between getting as much as one can get for oneself and giving back to society, between assuming everyone is in it for themselves and understanding that we're all in it together, between seeking personal celebrity, wealth, or power, and helping to build a better society for all. An education in civic virtue should explain why the latter choices are morally necessary. Such an education must also urge and equip young people to communicate with others who do not share their views. It should teach them how to listen, to open their minds to the possibility that their own views and preconceptions may be wrong, and to discover why people with opposing views believe what they do. It should enable them to work with others to separate facts and logic from values and beliefs, and help them find facts and apply logic together, even if their values and beliefs differ. These lessons cannot be learned only in the classroom. A true civic education also requires learning by doing. Young people must develop the habits of the heart, as Tocqueville called them, by taking on responsibilities in their communities, working in homeless shelters and soup kitchens, tutoring, mentoring, coaching kids' sports teams, helping the elderly and infirm. Young people need to move out of their bubbles of class, race, religion, and ideology, and to go to places and engage in activities where people look different from themselves and have different beliefs and outlooks from their own. They must learn to communicate with them. They need to learn how to learn from them. 2 years of required public service would give young people an opportunity to learn civic responsibility by serving the common good directly. It should be a duty of citizenship. This is how we once regarded military service. From World War II until the final days of the Vietnam War in January 1973, nearly every young man in America faced the prospect of being drafted. Sure, many children of the rich found means to stay out of harm's way, but the draft at least spread responsibility and heightened the public's sensitivity to the human costs of war. Richard Nixon officially ended the draft and created a paid military, mainly to take the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement, and he succeeded. Since then, the United States has had what's called an all-volunteer army. Volunteer only in the sense that for some young people, these jobs are the best they can get. Today's military is composed of fewer young people from rich families than the population as a whole. When compared with other groups of the same age, the military also has more Southerners and a higher percentage of African Americans. Most come from the same kind of blue-collar households whose incomes have gone nowhere for four decades. It's easy to support a war that you don't have to fight in. A 2004 survey showed that the majority of young people supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq, but only a small minority were themselves willing to fight in that war. 2 years in the armed services, or in some other service to the nation, would help instill in all young people a sense of their obligations to society, regardless of their family's wealth or status. It would allow young Americans to connect with other Americans who differ from them by race, social class, and politics. Not incidentally, it might also remind many upper-income Americans of the personal costs and risks of American foreign policy. Public service could take many forms in addition to military service. The Peace Corps could be revived and expanded. Projects like Teach for America could be enlarged and extended to other service professions like Social Work for America. Nonprofits could offer a range of public service work. All such recruits would be paid a modest stipend, at least living expenses, plus interest payments on any student loans. That would be less than the current pay of all-volunteer Army recruits. Whenever the idea of national service comes up, some object that no one should be forced to serve their country. In 2003, when George W. Bush proposed expanding AmeriCorps, the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal grumbled that the entire concept of paid volunteerism is an oxymoron. Dick Armey, then House Majority Leader, opined, "We give least well when we give it the direction and supervision of the government. The idea that government can teach charity to America rings very hollow with me." Rubbish. Young people were forced to serve their country when we had a draft. We require children to attend school for 16 years in order to learn the basics. Why shouldn't they be required to put in 2 years of public service to help learn the basics of citizenship? Besides, national service has nothing whatever to do with government teaching charity. It's about teaching civic virtue. Universities could also devote the second semester of the junior year to public service. This wouldn't be a break from a student's education, but an inherent part of it. Once learned, civic virtue must be practiced. As I hope I've made clear, our obligations as citizens go beyond voting, paying taxes, obeying the law, and serving on juries. We owe to one another our time and energies to improve our communities and to protect and strengthen our democracy. This should not be thought of as charity either. It's a commitment to pass on to future generations a society that comes closer to its ideals than it was when it was passed on to us. I've noted that a majority of today's Americans worry that the nation is losing its national identity. If you examine our history, you'll see that the core of that identity has not been the whiteness of our skin or the uniformity of our ethnicity. It's been the ideals we share, the good we have held in common. If we're losing our national identity, it's not because we come in more colors or speak more languages than before. It's because we're losing our sense of common good. This is what must be restored. That common good, as I have emphasized, is a set of shared commitments to the rule of law and to the spirit as well as the letter of the law, to our democratic institutions of government, to truth, to tolerance of our differences, to equal political rights and equal opportunity, to participating in our civic life and making necessary sacrifices for the ideals we hold in common. We must share these commitments if we are to have a functioning society. They inform our judgments about right and wrong because they constitute our common good. Without them, there's no we. Whether that common good can be recovered will depend in part on establishing a new ethic of leadership based on trusteeship, an appropriate application of honor and shame, a renewed commitment to truth, and a dedication to the civic education of our children and ourselves, about the obligations we owe one another as citizens. Some of you may feel such a quest to be hopeless. The era we're living in offers too many illustrations of greed, narcissism, and hatefulness. I, however, firmly believe it is not hopeless. Almost every day, I witness or hear of the compassion and generosity of ordinary Americans. Their actions rarely make headlines, but they constitute much of our daily life together. The challenge is to turn all this into a new public-spiritedness extending to the highest reaches in the land, a public morality that strengthens our democracy, makes our economy work for everyone, and revives trust in the major institutions of America. The moral fiber of our society has been weakened, but it has not been destroyed. We can recover the rule of law and preserve our democratic institutions by taking a more active role in politics. We can protect the truth by using facts and logic to combat lies. We can fight against all forms of bigotry. We can strengthen the bonds that connect us to one another by reaching out and help resurrect civility by acting more civilly toward those with whom we disagree. We've never been a perfect union. Our finest moments have been when we sought to become more perfect than we had been. We can help restore the common good by striving for it and showing others it's worth the effort. I worked for Robert F. Kennedy a half century ago when the common good was well understood. Resurrecting it may take another half century or more. But as the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr once said, "Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history." This is Robert B. Reich. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Common Good. This program was directed by Lisa Wattstein, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by Robert B. Reich. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.